Welcome to the Master Your Health podcast, your top resource for all things nutrition, fitness, and health. I'm your host, Amanda Rocchio, best known for my meal prep and nutrition content. And today I'm here with my co-host, the research junkie between the two of us, and my husband, Chris Rocchio.
Hello, everyone.
Today we're back with part two of our top nutrition and fitness myths podcast. We hope you enjoyed part one, and we're really excited to bring you part two on dispelling a lot of these common myths. Because nutrition is already confusing enough, we want to leave you feeling confident about your choices and that you're on the right path. I'm going to be honest with you, before I met Chris, I know I fell prey to a lot of these common myths more often. Now, granted, I've been in the nutrition field for a while now, so that within itself has helped me, but I do give credit to Chris for being able to spot logical fallacies a bit more and really diving into the weeds on a lot of these studies. So basically, we really want to equip you today with the right information, and hopefully in the future, you'll start to question extreme nutrition statements, especially when it comes to your own health, and find the nuance on each subject.
Yeah, we really have to make a distinction between people that are just trying to honestly disseminate information and just trying to inform the public versus activists that are starting with the conclusion and then working backwards to try to find the premises to try to convince you of their argument. And that's essentially what we're dealing with in a lot of these topics, whether we're talking about high protein being bad for kidneys or causing bone loss, or another one of our myths today is the diet heart hypothesis in terms of like the whole cholesterol, saturated fat, supposed link to coronary heart disease, all these different things. So we're going to dive into this, but just as a general rule, just be on the lookout for activists trying to convince you of a certain foregone conclusion.
As you can see, Chris is good at spotting the, you know, the weak statements within arguments. I wouldn't want to get in a debate with Chris. I'd be honest, I'd probably lose, except for I'm his wife, so he lets me win anyway sometimes, but that's the truth. So like he said, we're starting off with myth number one, which is high protein is bad for kidneys or can cause bone loss. So where did this myth come from? It really stemmed from a study that showed that people on high protein diets had more calcium in their urine, which led people to believe that this calcium came from breaking down bones in order to balance their pH of the blood. So, ooh, definitely scary, right? The problem here is there's actually no association between the amount of acid in the urine and calcium levels in your body. So if you eat more protein, yes, you will pee out more acid and calcium, but the amount of calcium in your body does not change. Not to mention the increase in intestinal absorption of calcium with high protein diets. So to emphasize this, there is actually a study done on bodybuilders, which gave them 3.3 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. And what they showed in the study is there were no harmful effects on the kidney or liver, and the blood lipid levels were actually ideal. As for bone loss, there's actually a study done on trained women and men, and there was no change in bone mineral density with a high protein diet. So here's the deal. We've discussed on previous episode that there are a ton of benefits from eating a high protein diet, from increased satiety to a better metabolism to better muscle retention. High protein diets have so many health benefits. So don't let this myth deter you from getting in more protein.
Yeah, absolutely. That's my favorite one on this whole list right there.
Chris loves his protein. He actually started the day with some grass-fed steak, which the kitchen smells really good right now. I'm a little envious.
More often than not, steak for breakfast. Yeah, don't knock on steak and eggs. It's not just something you have to treat yourself at a diner. You know, do it for yourself. All right, number two, myths around sunscreen. So yeah, I've heard arguments on both sides. I've had people come up and say that the reaction to sunlight and sunscreen is actually the thing that causes cancer. And then obviously you have the mainstream line that says that, you know, you should be putting sunscreen on all the time or you're going to get cancer. And the problem with this is that it's you're on too much of the extremes. If you put sunscreen on all the time, then you're not going to absorb vitamin D efficiently to get adequate amounts, and you'll need to supplement, which is, you know, it's fine. There are people that live in primarily dark regions of the world, you know, say like if you live in Scandinavia, there are long periods of time that you get very little sunlight. And so they actually, as a mandate, have a very high amount of supplementation of vitamin D there. So there's nothing wrong with it, but ideally you want to get it from the sun, because you're not having to worry about absorption problems, because you need to have vitamin D with fat, because it's a fat soluble vitamin, all these other things. So you could be taking 5,000, 6,000, even 10,000 IUs of vitamin D a day, but that doesn't mean you're absorbing every bit of it. Whereas vitamin D that you create from the sun is obviously, it's already there, it's bioavailable, and you're using it, and it acts like a hormone. So it's necessary. So you want to ideally be in the middle of these two extremes, and that is get a little bit of sun before you apply the sunscreen.
So that would be about 10 to 15 minutes. I mean, it depends on how, I'm sure, how fair your skin is, but 5 to 15 minutes without sunscreen and then put sunscreen on after that? Or what would you recommend in terms of time-wise overall?
Well, if you're like pale as printer paper, then you may want to start with like 5 minutes of exposure before you put sunblock on, and then you know, titrate up to 7 and then 10. It really just depends on your base. But the number one thing is you don't want to burn, because I'm kind of getting ahead of myself with the notes here. But since we're already talking about it, there have been studies that have shown that people that are, say, like weekend warriors that stay inside all day, all week, and then will go to a barbecue or go play a sport or something like that for, you know, 3-4 hours of sun exposure, and then they get burnt, you're much more likely to develop long-term skin damage and skin cancer when you're burning constantly over and over again, and then healing and then burning again, than if you're going outside and, say, if you work out in the sun for 4 hours a day, all day, every day, and you've built up a base, right? And you're not getting burnt. So it's kind of, like I said, it's the nuance. So you want to go out, get a little bit of sun, start getting a little bit of color, and then you can start increasing your sun exposure. So like I said, 5 minutes exposure on the front and back, and then put the sunscreen on, and then you can increase from there. So it's going to depend on your natural melanin and things like that. And then not only that, but there's also some nuance with melanin as well, that the more melanin, or the darker the natural pigment of your skin, the less you're going to convert sunlight to vitamin D, and it's going to be less efficient. So you actually need more sun exposure. So say somebody that lives whose genetic background is in sub-Saharan Africa, you need far more sun exposure than somebody that lives in Scandinavia to get the same amount of vitamin D. So you have to take that into consideration, because if you look at, just in the US is when these studies are primarily done, but if you look at, you know, say the white population in the US versus Hispanic and African Americans, there's a direct relationship between the darkness of your skin color and vitamin D deficiency. That is to say that African Americans have the largest prevalence of vitamin D deficiency, and then Hispanic Americans, and so on. And so you can actually follow that as a kind of a general rule as to how to gauge your sun exposure and the ideal amount.
Absolutely. That makes sense to me. And again, looking at these myths, as you can see, usually the answer lies within the nuance.
And another thing people overlook is the potential sun exposure they could get through the window while they're sitting in their car, or maybe sitting at a desk next to a window working. And the problem with this is the window pane actually filters out UVB light and allows UVA light through. And the difference is, and this is important to understand the difference between the UVB and the UVA rays. So UVB rays are responsible for producing sunburn, you know, skin inflammation, and the local skin damage that actually is more noticeable in sunburns. And UVB rays also play the greatest role in causing skin cancers. And so that's the deadly black mole form of skin cancer called malignant melanoma. And UVA rays also play a role in skin cancer formation. So it's not, you know, black or white here. It's not just the UVB that's the problem. But UVA rays also penetrate the skin more deeply, and they play a greater role in premature skin aging and, you know, like the wrinkles and things like that. It's called photoaging. And there are approximately 500 times more UVA rays in sunlight than UVB. So this is a problem because we can overlook it. We think that we're inside, we think we're protected, and even though that sun is shining straight through the window, hitting our skin, we kind of overlook that. So you want to be aware of this and have sunblock at your table or at your desk, and also maybe sitting in your console or your glove box in your car. So when you do have those situations where you're taking that long 1-hour drive, or you're sitting at your desk for a few hours, you want to make sure you have that available and you're not overlooking that.
I know, I need to get in the habit more of putting on sunscreen. As I've gotten older, I've taken more care of this, and I have this brand I use. It's called Verse Mineral Sunscreen. I like for my face. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to do that more. You know, ladies, we're all worried about the wrinkles.
Yeah, and the wrinkles, like I said, the skin aging and wrinkles, again, that's UVA penetration that causes that primarily. And so that's why you want to make sure that you have good sunscreen. And the good sunscreen actually brings us to the next myth, which is all sunscreens provide adequate protection. And this isn't an indictment on all sunscreens. It's just some of them are very poor quality and they may advertise as being broad spectrum protection, but actually they will prioritize the protection from UVB rays and still allow some UVA rays through. And there have been studies to show that some of these cheaper broad spectrum quote unquote sunblocks actually let in the same amount of UVA exposure as sitting in a tanning bed for 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
So yeah.
That's
so
like, pretty crazy.
So it's really crazy and you really have to pay attention to the quality. So like maybe your $5 big bottle one of Costco isn't really doing what you think it is. And we can speculate on why they decide to prioritize the UVB blocking. I mean, it is the primary cause of sunburn, so it is more easily detectable by consumers. If the product's not working and you're getting sunburnt, then it's more easily detected than, say, you're getting that deep penetration, long-term skin damage, but you can't notice it until far down in the future when you start getting wrinkles and the aging and all that kind of stuff. And not only that, but it's also the UVB rays are primarily the cause of malignant melanoma. So obviously, whether you're talking about the biggest risk for sun damage being cancer and the short-term risk being sunburns, you can kind of see why. I mean, I don't know, I'm not positive that that's why that they prioritize UVB, but as far as some of these cheaper sunblocks, there's definitely a disparity between the protection you're getting from both UVB and UVA rays. And what's funny is that countries in Europe require a equal protection between both types of UV rays. And about 70% of US products would fail their standards.
70%?
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
This is what I don't understand. When it comes to beauty products and food products, Europe has way better standards.
Right. And it's crazy because in the US, they have these very high SPF ratings, like 60 and 75, I think. And somebody said there's 100. I haven't seen 100 or whatever. But those are actually the ones that are so disproportional in letting UVB versus UVA rays through. So the recommendation is that you don't go higher than 50, because when you go higher than that, like the 60 and things like that, those are kind of misleading and could cause you to think that you have the protection when you really don't. So keeping it between about 15 and 50 SPF and apply it after a little bit of sun exposure.
I'm learning so much about SPF today, actually.
Nice. Well, that's what I'm here for, baby.
Who knew?
I'm teaching you too. So just to reiterate, we don't live at either ends of the extremes here. You know, we're not all about caking yourself in suntan lotion all the time, but we're also not about leaving yourself exposed for long amounts of time, right? So, and it's also going to depend on where you are genetically or where you're from genetically and things like that. So a lot of nuance to this subject, and be on the lookout for these false claims.
I will say I love a good tan in the summer, though.
Oh, of course.
I love to be golden brown.
Who doesn't?
Next on our list is the alkaline myth. And so there's a few subsets of myths within this. So Chris and I are going to walk through some of this. But really, the popularity of alkaline diets continue to grow in belief due to the fact that acid-forming foods lead to illness, and therefore eating alkaline foods will prevent this illness. But is that really true? We wanted to explore some of these premises further. So I'm going to start off with myth number one, which is food pH alters blood pH. Here's the truth. You can't alter the pH of your blood through diet unless literally your kidneys are failing. Blood pH has to stay within a very small range for you to survive. So that's about 7.35 to 7.45 pH. Going outside of that range is fatal, as in it can result in death. And so the body regulates the balance very efficiently with buffers. So basically your body wants to constantly maintain this pH homeostasis at all time. Now, keep in mind that your stomach acid is usually around a pH of 1.5 to 3, which is very acidic. And that's a good thing because your stomach acid has to break down food and proteins to get ready for intestinal absorption. A stomach with too high a pH, aka more alkaline, is not good because it's not really functioning properly. So drinking large amounts of alkaline water around your food is not a good idea. I know everyone's into the alkaline water now, so don't chug that with your food. If you want to buy it outside of that, fine. But again, it's not really doing anything much for you overall. And to reiterate, stomach acid is crucial for proper digestion of food and nutrient absorption. These nutrients are part of the buffer system mentioned above. So we don't want to neutralize the stomach acid because it's crucial for so many different functions and it will create a domino effect leading to other problems down the line. Also, some of the most crucial dietary components are acidic. So that's essential amino acids and fatty acids. So again, overall, food does not really have an effect on your blood pH. Now, if you're severely nutrient deficient to the point where your kidneys are failing, that's when we'd say food has an effect. But that's more of getting the right nutrients to support your body to function properly. So I hope that helps clear up the myth and the confusion when it comes to food pH and your blood pH.
So some say using urine pH strips can indicate body pH, but it's not a reliable indicator of anything other than how well our kidneys are functioning. One of its main jobs is to filter excess acid from the blood, which is eliminated primarily through urine and CO2. So that's a false metric for measuring blood pH, and it just leads you down the wrong track and the wrong causal relationships. And this whole urine acidity thing is actually tied into myth one that we talked about and the whole idea of osteoporosis and everything like that. So all of this is tied in, and all of these mechanisms have proven to not be related to another. But again, like I said at the beginning of this, this is all essentially propaganda to work their way backwards from the conclusion that you shouldn't be eating animal products. So myth number three, acid-forming diets contribute to modern disease. And the quote behind this is cancer can only grow in an acidic environment. But the truth is that the hypothesis depends on the validity of myth one that we talked about, which is that food pH alters blood pH. And we've already shown that that's false. So as noted above, blood pH is slightly alkaline. So every cancer experiment uses tissues with a 7.4 pH. So cancer can grow in alkaline environments. And what they've actually shown is that the causality is reversed from what their claim is. So acidity doesn't cause the cancer. It's the tumor itself that creates its own acidic environment in which to thrive. So they just flipped the causal relationship. And this was initially confirmed in a 2008 study, but multiple studies have followed up and actually proven the initial study wrong, that no, there is no link between an acid-forming diet and cancer. So you can just dispel that completely. So this is a good thing. So you don't have to completely avoid what they call acidic foods, but it also doesn't mean that you don't have to go after the foods that they're purporting are good for you, right? I mean, because all these alkaline foods like the fruits and veggies and everything like that, those are obviously good. So you should still get those in your diet, but it doesn't mean that you have to completely forego and eliminate all the animal products out of your diet.
Yeah, it really makes me wonder if all these people are adding in alkaline foods, which again are a lot of plant-based foods, which are great for you. And they think, wow, it's all the alkaline foods, but really it's all these wonderful plant-based compounds that are great for you that you're adding to your diet, and you don't necessarily need to subtract, you know, I mean, you shouldn't really subtract the beneficial acidic foods like beet and all that.
Right, which we're getting into the next point, because our myth number four is the diet heart hypothesis. And in case you're not familiar with that, that is basically that saturated fat from animal products and coconut oil, because it's primarily saturated fat, increases blood cholesterol concentrations, and that in turn, elevated blood cholesterol level is causally linked to increased risk of coronary heart disease. So first off, let's deal with one claim, and that eating cholesterol and saturated fat raises cholesterol levels in the blood. So a couple notes on cholesterol right off the bat. So because it's usually demonized as just this bad thing altogether, it is 100% essential. It's needed for cellular structure and repair, steroid hormone synthesis, and the insulation of nerve cells. On any given day, we have between 1,100 and 1,700 milligrams of cholesterol in our body. And only 25% of that comes from our diet, and 75% is produced inside our cells by the liver. And much of that cholesterol that's found in food can't actually be absorbed by our bodies. And the body tightly regulates the amount of cholesterol in the blood by controlling internal production. So that means that when cholesterol intake goes down, the body makes more. When cholesterol intake goes up, the body makes less.
Yeah, so this explains why well-designed cholesterol feeding studies where they feed volunteers 2 to 4 eggs a day and measure their cholesterol level show that dietary cholesterol has very little impact on blood cholesterol levels in about 75% of the population. They pretty much estimate that the remaining 25 to 30% of the population are hyper-responders. That is, when they ingest cholesterol, then their cholesterol levels go up. But in that 25 to 30%, dietary cholesterol does modestly increase both LDL, bad cholesterol, and HDL, good cholesterol, but it does not affect the ratio of LDL to HDL or increase the risk of heart disease. So this is also pretty good news if you're a hyper responder. So you can ditch the whole egg white omelet, only eating egg whites, because really the egg yolk is very nutrient dense. Egg yolks contain all 13 essential nutrients from the egg, because egg whites don't have much of the nutrients. And it also contains a good source of choline, which is a B vitamin that plays an important role in everything from neurotransmitter production to detoxification to maintenance of healthy cells. Studies actually show that up to 90% of Americans don't get enough choline, which can lead to fatigue, insomnia, poor kidney function, memory problems, and even nerve muscle imbalances. So kids, eat your egg yolks, eat your whole egg omelets. And if you're trying to lose weight and you kind of want to go for volume, sometimes Chris and I like to do, you know, a couple, 1 to 2 whole eggs, and then we'll use egg white carton and mix in some egg whites just to add to the volume of that food. But again, you really probably want to have at least one whole egg to get all the nutrients.
Yeah, and just to emphasize the importance of choline, especially if you're an athlete or if you train pretty heavily, choline is the precursor to acetylcholine, and that's actually the chief neurotransmitter of the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest and digest part of the nervous system that helps us, you know, relax and repair our cells and grow our cells and things like that. So it's extremely important. It's important for contracting muscle tissue, dilating blood vessels, increasing bodily secretions, and slowing heart rate. So all these things are related to your physical activity and should not be overlooked if you're physically active. All right, so within this myth, we also have to talk about the saturated fat portion, because that's also part of this argument. And this one's funny because every time Amanda and I would post meat, obviously I don't post on Instagram anymore, but Amanda covers that aspect. But when she posts meat and when I used to, almost without fail, at least one person is in the comment feeds citing one of these old studies from like 2003, 2004, showing the link to saturated fat and higher cholesterol. And this is the number one go-to study. And basically, and they even cite it incorrectly. When you actually read the study, it's used incorrectly because they talk about the link. But really what the study showed was that replacing trans fat with unsaturated fat, so that would be monounsaturated fat and polyunsaturated fat, had a greater effect in reducing the ratio of total cholesterol to HDL cholesterol than replacing trans fat with saturated fat. So basically, if you replace it with unsaturated fat, then you had almost twice the amount of reduction in that ratio than if you replace trans fat with saturated fat. It also showed that a particular type of saturated fat, lauric acid, increased total cholesterol, but mostly HDL, the good cholesterol. But like I said, it's mostly HDL. So there was some LDL. And even though activists use this as a premise in their argument, the very conclusion of this study states that, quote, the effects of fats on these risk markers should not in themselves be considered to reflect changes in risk, but should be confirmed by prospective observational studies or clinical trials. But they look past that and then go to the next sentence. And this is why you have to be careful when reading the verbiage. It says, quote, by that standard, risk is reduced most effectively when trans fatty acids and saturated fatty acids are replaced with unsaturated fatty acids. So in their mind, this is confirmation of their predetermined conclusion. But it's really saying that we just said this finding is uncertain and we should confirm this by follow-up studies. But in the event that this is confirmed, we can conclude that saturated fats are part of the problem. That's what that's saying.
Yes.
By saying by this standard, dot, 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 they're saying assuming this is confirmed, but you have to read the conclusion in its entirety. You can't just pluck out one sentence that refers to the previous sentence and then take that sentence out of context without citing the previous sentence. And then not only that, but then they ignore the sentence that follows that, which is, you know, like I said, it's only a suggestion of possible implications. But then they go on to reiterate directly after that by saying the effects of carbohydrates and of lauric acid-rich fats, so that's saturated fat, on coronary artery disease risk remain uncertain. So right then and there, they're just saying that the results of the study are inconclusive, but that is the number one study that is constantly cited.
And do you also have like a special hotline we can call so you can review all studies for us, Chris?
I know, seriously.
Master Your Health podcast, right?
Yeah. And it's crazy because the study was also done short term. It only lasted a few weeks, and longer term studies that were more well designed have not confirmed this initial association. And if you look at all of the longer term studies examining the same issue, only one of them out of dozens of them showed an association between saturated fat and cholesterol levels. And one, it was an observational study. So meaning it was based on, you know, surveys and, you know, didn't control for other lifestyle factors and things like that. And number two, the association was weak. So even if you say the jury is out and neither of these sides are conclusive, you know, that's fine. You know, I'm not taking a hard stance that you should just have an unlimited amount of saturated fat. That is not my argument. Obviously, I actually think that it's going to vary between the individual. Like, not everybody can have, a large amount of saturated fat. It's going to depend on the individual. The same way with cholesterol, you have hyper responders. Not everybody is going to respond to saturated fat the same way. But that's not my position. I'm not combating one extreme position by having the equal and opposite extreme. I'm just telling you that it's not that extreme. That's all. So I just want to reiterate that.
Yeah. I mean, and if you look to other experts in the field, they'll come to a similar conclusion that, you know, again, saturated fat is not something to be feared. And also, like, but that doesn't mean go pour pounds and pounds of butter, right?
Yeah.
I feel like butter is more of a condiment as you use smaller amounts, even something like coconut oil, which I do like to put in my coffee. I noticed that if I just use one teaspoon in the blender, like I'll do, this is good. I'm telling you, you should try this. One teaspoon coconut oil, hot coffee, some stevia, some cinnamon, blend that up. It comes out super creamy, but I don't even need a full tablespoon. You know, people on the bulletproof method are putting a tablespoon of coconut oil, a tablespoon of butter. It's a lot of fat. It's a lot of saturated fat. So something like that is where I start to bring into question, like, hey, what are we doing with all that? But again, I like the conclusion, obviously, the nuance, not being so extreme with our thoughts and nutrition practices.
Yeah, I mean, we evolved eating this stuff. It's part of our biology. So it's not as extreme as people make it out to be. And then there's also other problems when you're combining a large amount of saturated fat with a large amount of refined sugars, you know, and I don't want to get too much into this. You can look into Rhonda Patrick's and Robert Kraus, I think, Klaus Kraus. Sorry about that. I forgot what his name is, but they talk about actually specifically about the LDL particle and how they're not all the same. You have the large fluffy and then small dense, and it's actually the small dense LDL particle that is the main culprit and not LDL particles them in and of themselves. So the more you get into this argument about cholesterol or topic, not argument, you realize how nuanced it is. So initially it's like, not all cholesterol is bad. You have HDL versus LDL, you know, one's good, one's bad. And then now it's, oh, well, there's two different types of LDL cholesterol, some created by basically unwanted conditions in the gut and things like that. Like I said, we're not going to get into it, but if you really want to look into it, I would start looking into like small, dense LDL particles and those being the culprit.
I thought that was really interesting too, because again, LDL is supposed to be assumed to all be bad, and to see within LDL, there's obviously some better known particles.
Yeah.
So it's crazy. I mean, black and white doesn't work these days, guys.
Absolutely not. So on top of that, you have studies on low carbohydrate diets, which tend to be high in saturated fat. And they suggest that they not only don't raise blood cholesterol, but they have several beneficial impacts on cardiovascular disease risk markers. So a meta-analysis of 17 low-carb diet trials published in the Journal of Obesity Reviews found that low-carb diets neither increased nor decreased LDL cholesterol. However, they found that low-carb diets were associated with significant decrease in body weight, as well as improvements in several cardiovascular risk factors, including decreases in triglycerides, fasting glucose, blood pressure, body mass index, abdominal circumference, plasma insulin, and C-reactive protein, as well as an increase in HDL cholesterol. And not to mention all the other benefits that, you know, like diets high in saturated fat, such as like the ketogenic diet, and the benefits that that has with autoimmune diseases, epilepsy, you know, certain nervous system disorders, things like that. So this myth just flies in the face of a mountain of evidence that suggests otherwise. So if you're still wondering whether saturated fat may contribute to heart disease in some way that is related to cholesterol, a large meta-analysis of prospective studies involving close to 350,000 participants found no association between saturated fat and heart disease. And again, I'm going to have all of these studies in the show notes, so check those out. And on top of that, a Japanese prospective study followed 58,000 men for an average of 14 years found no association between saturated fat intake and heart disease, and an inverse association between saturated fat and stroke. So those who ate more saturated fat had a lower risk of stroke.
Wow, that's super fascinating.
So just as an overall guideline of your filter that you should have on these studies, these myths were originally based on observational studies showing that countries that consumed a lot of saturated fat had higher rates of death from heart disease. We all learned in high school science that correlation is not causation, but many forget to apply this when presented with correlation evidence that actually supports their foregone conclusions. So for example, many of these association studies that showed these links between saturated fat, cholesterol, and coronary heart disease are based on retroactive surveys that rely on memory and honest, accurate recording of past behavior. And sometimes these people have to track behavior years in the past, months in the past, things like that. And let's be honest, we all sometimes, like our memories fail us. We tend to concentrate on the good behavior that we are proud of and ignore and downplay some of the bad behavior. So, you know, the survey in and of itself is flawed, and it doesn't control for other lifestyle factors to actually pinpoint the causality. So if you have all these other factors in play, and by the limitations of the design and the methodology, you absolutely cannot determine causality there. So it's just a dishonest argument. So for instance, in some of these studies, on one hand, they would track the habits and prevalence of coronary heart disease of the omnivorous general population, you know, the people that don't make specific dietary choices, they're not very health conscious, and then compare that to like vegans and vegetarians, who generally speaking as a community are far more health conscious than the general population, and demonstrably so. So of course you would have better outcomes for, you know, in terms of biological markers and risk factors in the health conscious group than you would in just the normal general population. That's, I mean, think about it. The normal general population is 40% obese. So that's what you're dealing with there. But in subsequent studies that shows health conscious individuals on both sides, there was no difference in associated risk. And this is still talking about association, because like we said before, there's no causal link identified in any randomized controls trial or any study designed to actually find one. You know, any study that has the design and methodology that is adequate enough to determine a causal link.
Right. So really, there's no need to jump through hoops to avoid something that hasn't proven to be harmful and in reality is probably beneficial to you. Plus, U.S. dietary guidelines no longer have any restrictions on dietary cholesterol. We're all slightly different, so if you think you're one of the hyper responders to dietary cholesterol, work with your health practitioner and see what you can do to get your cholesterol levels into a more healthy, normal level. And also check whether eggs affect you positively. There are also other issues with eggs for some people, like as a common allergen. If you eat eggs every single day and never give yourself a break, it can become a common allergen. So it's nice to mix in other foods. But again, overall, you can conclude that saturated fat and dietary cholesterol will most likely not be a risk to your health or heart disease or coronary heart disease.
Yeah, especially because like Amanda said earlier, even if you are part of the 25 to 30% of hyper responders, that just means that your total cholesterol goes up, but it doesn't affect the HDL to LDL ratio, which is the problem. So there's still nuance, even if you are that. It's not like if you're a hyper responder, you should be watching out for cholesterol like it's, you know, the barbarian tribe on the hillside. It's still not going to kill you. You just have to be a little bit more conscious of it. And the results are in. I mean, the dietary guidelines that resulted from this myth, you know, they started in the mid-1900s and were vigorously pushed until just recently. They played an unintended role in the current epidemics of obesity, lipid abnormalities, lipid is fat, type 2 diabetes, and metabolic syndromes. And this isn't just what I'm saying. That's a quote from the Journal of American College of Cardiology. And even the founder of the diet heart hypothesis actually had to admit in the 90s that it no longer had any scientific support. So we can just dispel of this myth altogether.
So you know what's so crazy is people on social media will still say to me, well, you can't, it's illegal to say eggs are healthy. And I'm like, I'm assuming it came from back in the day during this time. I'm just like, we need to cut this out, guys.
They're pulling from like 1990s level of dietary guidelines, and it's awful.
So to go over the conclusions one more time, dietary cholesterol and saturated fat does not affect the ratio of HDL to LDL particles overall for most people. Only in about 25 to 30% of hyper responders will you'll see more of effect on your cholesterol levels. There is no causal link between saturated fat consumption and coronary heart disease. 90% of heart disease is caused by lifestyle factors, actually. So that'll be smoking, regular alcohol consumption, avoiding fresh produce, lack of physical activity, psychosocial factors, poor sleep, hypertension, obesity, etc. So it's more of these lifestyle factors. You really need to be looking at the big picture when it comes to your overall health. There's no difference in heart attack risk when comparing people with diets high in saturated fat and those who ate diets low in saturated fat. Using the meta-analysis, there is no causal link between saturated fat intake and cardiovascular disease. But actually, know that there is some relief around these myths, and you don't have to fear saturated fats or cholesterol like you might have in the past. So last on our list is myth number 5, which is a detox diet is the best way to jumpstart a change in your diet. So in general, you want to avoid some of these detox diets, especially because a lot of these sugary drinks, so a lot of these detox diets will involve sugary fruit juices, or sometimes they have products with lots of additives, which is just ironic to me because you're supposed to be detoxing the body and they have all these artificial ingredients added to their diet. What you really want to do is stay focused on your goal and look at your healthy choices as more whole food-based foods. So, you know, really minimize or eliminate those highly processed foods, get some movement in, drink lots of water, and that alone will allow your body to detox naturally because your liver itself acts as a detoxification for your whole body, in addition to a couple other systems like sweating, peeing, pooping. All of that is your body's natural detoxification system. Now, I don't want to completely write off all gut reset or reset diets. Some of them can be beneficial, whether it comes to fasting or trying a fast mimicking diet. But again, this is not really for weight loss per se. If you focus on fasting as a way to lose weight, you're going to end up in more of a crash diet zone. It's more of to reset your gut and to really help with cellular detoxification and autophagy. So there is some benefits within that, but don't fall for these crappy fit teas. They're just going to make you poop, and some weird herbs in that is like a really expensive green tea, basically, or these other crappy supplements where you really don't understand the research behind what they're doing for your body. So if you want to revamp your diet, don't feel like you need to go through some reset or some fasting diet to get there. You can just start off by changing your current meals to healthier whole food meals and enjoy a much more satiating meal versus starving yourself on what you think you should do, which would be like a juice cleanse. I mean, I remember in college, all my girlfriends would do that. They'd go on a binge weekend and then they'd try to do a juice cleanse. Like that would make up for it. And it's like, just drink your water, eat your healthy food, and that alone will help you detoxify. And maybe try not to binge drink on the weekends too much.
Yeah, and if you're looking for an additional resource on this, we had a guest on, Tyler Jean, and we had an actual podcast specifically talking about detox and some of the misconceptions surrounding it and things like that. And really, you don't need to do these crazy detox diets. You really just need to do maybe just something like eliminating certain things from your diet and giving your body a chance to catch up. So the analogy he used is the bathtub with a water faucet and a drain. The water faucet being the toxins, the bathtub being your, you know, essentially your body and its ability to hold toxic loads, and the drain being your detoxification, your natural detoxification process. And so your body has a natural detox system that you don't need additional supplements and all these other things to help with. I mean, you'd need the essential nutrients necessary to perform the functions, but you don't need all these, you know, marketing gimmicks and things like that to facilitate this process. You really only need to slow down the faucet by eliminating the toxic load in your body. So the whole thing is like, you don't have to overhaul everything, but let's just say you want to just incorporate more whole foods, not have as many processed foods with additional additives that have a small, slight amount of toxic load that could add and accumulate over the long run if you're constantly bombarding yourself. And also things like phthalates and parabens and other things that are in your household products that also add to your toxic load. So bottom line is, if you're generally healthy, you just concentrate on giving your body what it needs to maintain its natural detoxification. So that's a healthy diet, adequate fluid intake, regular exercise, sufficient sleep, and, you know, recommended medical checkups. But if you're experiencing things like fatigue, unexplained, you know, weight loss or gain, changes in bowel function or breathing difficulties that persist for days, then go to a doctor. Don't go to a detox spa or don't buy a detox product because you saw something on Instagram. In normal situations, your body is fully equipped if you give it the circumstances needed to detox itself.
Absolutely. So you heard it here first on the Master Your Health podcast. I hope you really enjoyed today's episode and got lots of value. We're going to continue down this path of dispelling all these fitness and nutrition myths so that you can live a healthy, thriving life with confidence. And thank you for tuning in to today's episode. We'll catch you on the next one. Bye.
Yep. See ya.